Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Dr. Catherine Meeks. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus, practicing nonviolence, and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin as usual with a little prayer. I just invite everyone listening just to take a deep breath wherever you are and to relax. And let's recenter ourselves and enter into the presence of the God of peace and love who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus here with us. Just take a moment to ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus, to bridge the rivers of difference and be ambassadors of reconciliation, and to work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, heal us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part to help end racism, poverty, greed, injustice, warfare, nuclear weapons, environmental destruction, and the whole systems of violence, that we might be your holy peacemakers, your ambassadors of reconciliation, and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. It's a blessing to welcome my friend Dr. Catherine Meeks, a nationally recognized leader in racial healing and transformation, the founder of the Turquoise and Lavender Institute for Transformation and Healing. Her latest book is Bridging the Rivers of Difference, a Proclamation of Unity in Resistance. In 2022, she was honored with the President Biden Lifetime Achievement Award for her many decades of work for racial justice and advancing dialogue, reconciliation, and community-based healing. Her other books include The Night is Long, But Light Comes in the Morning, Meditations on Racial Healing, and her memoir, The Quilted Life, Reflections of a Sharecropper's Daughter. Dr. Meeks previously served as founding director of the Absalom Jones Episcopal Center for Racial Healing and the Lane Center for Community Engagement and Service at Wesleyan College, and Aunt Maggie's Kitchen Table, a family resource center in Macon, Georgia. And she spent 25 years as chair of the African American Studies Program at Mercer University and later served as professor of sociocultural studies at Wesleyan College. She holds her PhD from Emory and lives in Atlanta. Catherine Meeks, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here and have this conversation with you.
It's great. Well, as I just told everyone, you've spent your life teaching, promoting, speaking, and writing about racial justice, racial healing, spiritual transformation, and reconciliation in all its forms. So it's just a big, broad invitation here. Tell us about your journey and this work over the years.
Well, it's a long journey, and I'll have to make short work of it because we don't have that much time to talk. So I want to say that actually earlier today, I was just saying to somebody, at the end of the day, the one abiding commitment I have, as you have to nonviolent work, I have to healing work. You know, I believe that at the end of the day, all of us are, much like Henry Nouwen said, just wounded healers trying to tell each other where the bandage closets are. And that's what I've been doing, is I found a few bandages and I've been happy to share those closets with people, both in teaching and writing and leading workshops across the United States and a few other places, actually, around the issue of race, because race is a symptom of our brokenness that comes to the forefront because of the ways in which we've constructed the society. But, you know, we're just broken for so many reasons. But, of course, race takes the lead oftentimes. And then, of course, gender and class are great competitors of race. So I have just felt because of my own background, growing up poor and black in Arkansas and being marginalized and seen as a second or third class citizen, that my way of being in the world was going to be to stand against that and to say that's not how God sees us. So I have had for all my life pretty much this sense of connecting to the spiritual and to God and to the world bigger than me, and knowing that in that world people were to be treated right. And you know, it sounds awfully simple when I start talking about it, but it hasn't been simple, as most people know. If you're on any kind of serious intentional journey, it's never simple because there's so many competing energies. But I am very grateful for the grace and the guidance of the Spirit and all of the folks around me that have helped me to go from being that little girl scared to death often in Arkansas to this empowered woman who isn't afraid of most things.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm so glad you mentioned Henry and his great teaching that we're called to be wounded healers. Alas, yes. Catherine, what we're seeing play out everywhere is wounded wounders, mm-hmm. wounded people who continue to wound and inflict permanent wounds, not just on each other here in that country, but around the world and to Mother Earth herself. After all mm-hmm. you've done, all you've taught and been through, I don't know if you would agree. We're just like worse than ever with the current Republican administration dismantling democracy, civil and voting rights, bringing in, well, everything they can to bring back white supremacy and full-on mm-hmm. fascism, plantation capitalism, which, in other words, we're just pretty much only serving white billionaires, and cutting mm-hmm. all the programs for the poor, for women and children at home and around the world, but billions still for war and killing people mm-hmm. and rebuilding the nuclear weapon industry and closer to nuclear war and worsening climate chaos. So I hate to ask you this, but I think it would really help if you just spoke a little bit from your perspective on the crisis we're all facing today.
Well, you know, on the one hand, it's incredibly sad. And on another hand, it grieves us. We have to be grieved and outraged at the mistreatment and especially the deaths. I've been keeping up with the deaths that have occurred just from the tearing down of USAID.
Yes.
That makes me grieve at a very deep level, and it enrages me. But on the other hand, I see this moment as the moment when people really have got to come to grips with what kind of humans they want to be. And we have got to, you know, we are being offered an opportunity as the average person walking on this planet to make a decision about, do we want to support the nonsense that we see this regime doing and trying to create, or do we want to stand against it? And is this the hill we're willing to die on? And I really do think that we're being given an opportunity to make some changes. And I also, even though I think Trump is a huge problem, I don't think Trump is the problem. I think our problem has been, in this United States, we have not been honest about who we really are. And now Trump has come and found the cracks, and his Project 2025 people and the Heritage Foundation, who have been relentlessly trying to find somebody to allow them to do their agenda, are busy doing their agenda. So I think we need to name the right enemy, and then we need to work hard to deconstruct their energy and put them out of business. And so while I don't like Trump, nobody's going to think I like Trump at the end of this conversation. But what I don't do is hold him singularly responsible for the mess we're in. I think it's bigger than he is. I think he is in some ways, he's a pawn in a game that I don't even think he understands. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we have got to, I don't see us naming the real culprits as much as we need to. everything is kind of focused on him because he's the president. But we could, you know, if we really, I mean, we've got to be, we people of faith have got to be more astute than that and really know who the, where the real enemies are. And we can't be living under some kind of illusion. So if Trump died tomorrow, we would still have a problem.
Do you want to say a word about these real enemies? You've already named them, racism, sexism, classism, of violence, and you get into them in your book, but do you want to unpack them anymore?
Yes, I do want to say that I think since this country was founded upon the notion of some humans being better than others, when we wrote the Constitution, Black people weren't considered human, and neither were women. So the Constitution wasn't talking about us when it was talking about promoting the general welfare and creating a more perfect union. And we have been living out that hierarchical, that kind of human value hierarchy all the time with, you know, so if white men with power are going to be more important than Black men with power or no power, and women and other people of color and white men with no power, if there's going to be a class of white men that get to do everything and be everything and say everything, which is basically how we got started, and we have done a whole lot to try to keep that going. And I think the Heritage Foundation has been living into that value system all the time and just working diligently to find a way to do what they're doing right now with Project 2025. So knowing all of that, then what do we do? And that's why I wrote Bridging the Rivers of Difference, because I believe that the people of color who are going to be a majority here in a half a hot minute going into the future, I think we have got to come together to become focused on how to really change the energy systems so that people can be, everybody can be considered a worthy citizen in this country. And I think we can do it because we will be a majority if we can quit seeing each other as enemies and start really working together as collaborative partners.
That's wonderful and exciting. I love your book. So tell me about it, Bridging the Rivers of Difference, A Proclamation of Unity in Resistance.
So the hardest book I've ever written. And when I was writing it, there were many times I'd go to bed at night and say, oh, I don't think I can do this because I'm going to sound like I've just lost my mind. And people are going to wonder what kind of crazy, what was she on when she was writing this? And then I would wake up the next day and have some idea that, that got me back into the, got me to the computer and got me going again. Because it is so, it is a big thought to think about how could you even get the just the four major groups together, Native people, African Americans, Asians, and Latinos. We are so divided and so sure that we're each other's enemies. So how can you get us together? And so talking about that, you know, was making me feel like I was daydreaming in a world that just is impossible. But I also believe that that scripture that says, "What you know, the people perish if they don't have a vision." And so I think you got to be able to imagine a change, imagine a different way if you ever expect that there's any chance a new way of seeing can come. So this is my, this propelled me to get this book done. And the publisher was so excited about this concept. They kind of threw me off because they started publicizing it before I ever got it written. And that really worried me because I thought you might be getting ahead of yourself. You know, but they, I guess they believed in me along the way there more than I actually thought they did. And I did get it done, and it's now out, and people can read it and think about it themselves and think about what would it take for you to be willing to imagine a world, a country, where we actually did promote the general welfare and really work at having a more perfect union where everybody had what the basic things are that you need to live your life to the best of your ability. Why can't we have a country like that? There's no reason why we can't. But we have to believe that we can, and we have to be willing to stop having a hierarchy of human value that says some humans deserve to be here and have more than others, just like we just got through doing with the 14th Amendment. I mean, what kind of, who are we to be arguing about birthright citizenship? Everybody born here should be a citizen. That should never have been a part of anybody's conversation. And the fact that it was is just another, for me, another piece of evidence about how the Heritage Foundation and Stephen Miller and all of these billionaires think that they're better than everybody else.
Yeah.
And we have got to be, we are the majority to say, no, that's not going to be the way this place is going to be.
One of the arguments you make at the beginning of your book is you, in describing the divisions along mm-hmm. racial lines, is that you call it racial division is grounded in othering. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the basis for your beginning mm-hmm. to move toward unity and resistance. Tell me about what that means and how it's being practiced today. I mean, you could go back, of course, through the indigenous history, the genocide there, but it's just a long history, I guess, of othering.
Yeah, I think I want to go further than the genocide against the indigenous people. I start out the book with that concept, talking about Cain and Abel. And when Cain felt like God didn't like his sacrifice as much as he did Abel's sacrifice, instead of him asking, well, how can I improve? What do I need to do? What would make my sacrifice more acceptable to you, God? He decides it's his brother's fault and kills it. So othering is assigning whatever is wrong in your life, whatever your shortcomings are, whatever your deficits, whatever your neurosis, whatever, the list can go on and on, assigning it to other people and then deciding that if you can get rid of them, you'll be okay. But the fact of the matter is you won't be, because it's inside of you. Your problem is you. And so you didn't kill yourself, so you still got your problem. And just like at the present moment, the Trump administration and his whole propaganda machine is trying to convince us that everything that's wrong in this country is the fault of Latino people. And we just got to get rid of them. If we get rid of them, we'll be okay. That is just such an example of othering and so far from the truth, because whatever problems we have are the problems we have. And it's not even any one particular group of people responsible for those problems. So until you're willing, you know, Jung would talk about this as the shadow, I guess, in some ways. I talked about it as othering because that's just another way to talk about assigning things to other people that belong to you, your psychological, spiritual shortcomings of challenges or whatever, assigning that to other people and then wanting to get rid of them, which is so silly, because when you do that, you give other people power over your life. I mean, if I say that you're the blame for how I'm behaving, then I'm saying you have to fix me. So what about my own power? And I don't think people have thought about that very much when they have, you know, it's somebody else's fault. Well, does that somebody else run your life? Or do you think maybe you want to claim your power back and be in charge of yourself?
This is very, very important. I've thought this and talked about it myself for almost 50 years now. Because mm-hmm. I think, you know, the minute you say someone is other, mm-hmm. you're on the path of dehumanizing them, or as you say, yeah. giving them more power, you're dehumanizing yourself. But once you do that, then the next thing you know, there's the enemy, and then you can be like Cain and kill the person. That's
right.
Why I always thought, like when I was a kid trying to figure Martin Luther King out, what does this mean, nonviolence? And then I defined it as remembering who we are. We, mm-hmm. everyone is the beloved son and daughter of God. And therefore, mm-hmm. we're not alone. Every other human being on the planet is their sister and brother. But the minute you forget that, well, then you can be violent to others. And that's what you're telling. I mean, and race is total violence. And it leads to Cain and Abel. And I think what you're telling us is very important. But I'm getting off the book a little bit here, but you have for decades done workshops on racial healing and spiritual transformation. And I wonder if you could just give us a few of your basic lessons. I know that's another big question, but what do you focus on when you're trying to work with groups of people? To get over othering, I suppose, right?
Well, I think one of the things I've come to, I've been doing this work for, I'm 80. I turned 80 in February.
Happy
I've
birthday.
Been doing this, thank you. I've been doing this work since I was in my 20s, for over 50 years. So, but I'm clear about, first of all, people have to decide what kind of human they want to be. You know, do you want to be somebody walking around holding on to a lot of fears and grudges, and or do you want to be a free person? Do you want to be a well person? And so I try to talk about that because white people have a hard time believing that racism has injured them in any kind of way. Mm-hmm. And it has injured them. It has injured us all. There's nobody that lives in this country that's not affected by racism, and racism causes wounds, and you have to figure out how you've been wounded. And then you have to decide if you want to do something about those wounds. And so if you show up in a racial healing workshop, I assume that you at least want to do something about the wounds, or else somebody made you come to the meeting. Either way, you got there. And in our case, a lot of times those trainings were mandated in our diocese, so people felt like they had been made to come to the meeting, but then once they got there, they discovered that it was valuable. So we talk about the history and all of those things, but at the end of the day, we do a lot of things to try to help people do self-reflection or self-interrogation, where you begin to look at yourself and see, how am I living in the world? Do I drive down the road projecting all kinds of thoughts and ugly comments to myself about somebody because they look different from me? And if I do, why am I doing that? What is wrong with me? What is the value of that? So I really am big on self-interrogation, because you've got to look in the mirror and be honest about what you see. And until you do that, you're not going to do anything else anyway.
I wonder,
you know, because you're just hiding.
I want to read a sentence from your book and ask you to reflect with us on it. You write, "White people who wish to move from ally to becoming a trusted and trustworthy companion have to come to terms with the inferiority narrative and other parts of the master narrative that support the racial hierarchies and the suppression and oppression that accompany them." I agree with you, and I want you to tell us about that.
Well, there's this whole notion that, you know, skin color, the whiter white people are better than people of color. And if you're a person of color, the whiter you are, the better off you are, the smarter you are. That's the master narrative. That's the narrative of people of color are inferior to people who are white. That got started a long time ago when black folks and enslaved folks, actually, and native people came together in that moment that we now label as Bacon's Rebellion, when the white man discovered that the native people and the enslaved folks were going to be a force they didn't really want to deal with. They started making white skin bigger and more important than it really is. And so if you operate in that arena, then you, as a white person, you may not think that narrative has followed you through the generations and brought you to a place where, on some deep level, you have a little bit of a twinge of being a little bit better than somebody who's not white. You have privileges to reinforce that. The culture reinforces that. All kinds of things in America reinforces that notion. And so until, as a white person, you're willing to come to terms with that and face it and own it and not try to talk yourself out of it, you just kind of, you know, playing around in the racial healing field until you come to terms with that, because that is a wound, and it's a wound that has to be healed, because nobody's any better than anybody else ever. I mean, God made us all, and I'm totally, that's a hill I'm going to die on, that nobody is better than anybody else. We're all here together, and we're all made in God's image, and we deserve to be loved and treated right. And so if you believe that, then you have to let go of, well, I'm a little bit better because I'm a little bit lighter than you. I mean, in the communities of color, we call it colorism, where we people who are black and brown start looking at our shades of black and brown and deciding who is better than who else. And, you know, think about what a silly game that is. Mm-hmm. And how destructive it is and divisive. And we have to get off that horse of inferiority, the hierarchical human value. We got to get off that horse. And until you get off of it, you're just going to be playing a game with yourself about really caring about changing. And so I think that white people who want to be truly walking alongside people of color in this struggle for real, honest to goodness, justice, and freedom need to come alongside us, understanding that they are wounded as well. And they're not coming to help us. They're coming to help themselves. They're coming to get well themselves. And yes. And so we can be partners, as Henry Nouwen says, we can be partners in looking for bandage closets together rather than you coming to help me save myself. Are you coming to tell me where the bandage closets are? Because you don't know where they are either. We're working together, walking together to find them.
I love the goal of your book, Bridging the Rivers mm-hmm. of Difference, which to me is a call for unity and resistance. I just think that is so important. Really, you're inviting everybody to put down their divisions and get with the movement. And the way I look at it is every human being in the U.S. now, of course, the world is already there, but we have to be full-time nonviolent resistors for the rest of our lives. And you're inviting us to go grow beyond just allies, but to find our common ground in our woundedness and be wounded healers and trustworthy companions and maybe even friends across all the barriers. But why? For unity, to resist, to transform the culture. So, and as I'm reading your book and thinking about that great phrase, unity in resistance, I just, it's one of the great geniuses of Dr. King, which is not talked about enough, what he did in January 1968 in launching the Poor People's Campaign, bringing all the different groups of poor people and people of color together. He said it had never been done before, like they were doing it. And that was the future. And that's what I hear you calling for. So tell me about that. At the end of the book, you give some concrete new ways to move forward in unity and resistance. I think it'd be real helpful if you talked about that with our listeners.
Well, I think we have to go back beyond when we started with these narratives of inferiority and all that nonsense. So I believe that we've got so much more in common than we have than what is different for us. But we have to go back to our stories, to our ancestors' stories, to our ancient stories of wisdom. I believe we need to try to recover some of that and sit together as diverse groups and talk about those stories and look at what we share. Like the four major groups that I talk about in the book share river symbolism. All of them have many, many different kinds of ways of thinking about rivers and the power of rivers in their lives historically and through their ancestral heritage. We need to claim that. We need to try to get back before colonization and all of the ways we've decided to marginalize Asians and Latinos when they were brought here to help us forge the Industrial Revolution, to talk to each other and get off of this, my oppression's worse than yours. You know, I talk about Oppression Olympics, which is trying to see who's the most oppressed. I mean, that's another really silly argument to be having, because if you're oppressed, you're oppressed, and it doesn't really matter how. You're not free. And so I want us to get to meet in small groups for a period of time where all we're doing is trying to get to know each other and learn to respect one another. Because if we don't respect each other as equal humans, we're not going to do anything anyway, because eventually all of that shadow stuff and othering is going to come out and take over, as it has been doing in the past. And so I think that we have got to get, we've got to get to respect. We've got to get to knowing each other at a level beyond what the master narrative has given us and we've internalized. You know, we, this notion of I'm better than you, we've internalized that. And but way back, our ancestors knew better, and we need to hear them speak to us. And it requires, you know, it requires understanding that sometimes the way forward is not really, the way ahead is really not forward. That the, I think in this case, the way ahead is to take some steps back into our historical narratives that go beyond when the explorers stepped on this land and said, there's nobody here. We have to go back beyond that, because that was a really big mistake that they made when all the Native people were here and they didn't consider them to be worthy and just, you know, to be folks they need to get rid of. So we have to get beyond those stories and hear what was there before that. That's one thing. And then the second thing is that we have to create new narratives. We have to create new narratives, and we have to trust each other enough to be willing to work on common, to really be willing to promote the general welfare, to work on a common agenda, to work on things that benefit everybody and not just one group or one set of people. And, you know, sometimes when you do that, for a while you may not get your favorite thing, but you are working for the good of the whole. And not, so it's not just all about you getting your favorite thing. It's about you being willing to trust the group and the process and to believe enough in the community to really be glad that if we have better schools, that'll help you, even though maybe you really wanted to build a grocery store. And maybe if you are willing to stay in the conversation, you'll get around to building a grocery store. But we get into, you know, our egos rule rather than ruling, having the understanding that the welfare of the community is more important than one person's ego. But how many times have we let stuff just get spoiled because somebody wanted to have it their way and they couldn't, and eventually the whole thing tumbles down. So we got a lot of work to do, and this is why I sometimes felt like I was just gonna go crazy trying to talk about this, because it does on the surface seem impossible, but you know, nothing is impossible if you have faith and you're willing to get on the path and stay faithful.
I'm glad you talked about the ego, because you see it there in the Cain Abel story. It's,
yeah,
it's everywhere, and it leads to racism and murder and warfare and let's destroy the planet because I'm not getting my way. I'm a spoiled rich white guy. In the midst of all of this, you know, you're here as a guest in the Nonviolent Jesus podcast, and you know that has been much of my own work, has been to reclaim the nonviolence of Jesus for Christians in the church. Could you share any thoughts and themes that you're sitting with these days in the midst of this beautiful and difficult work of racial healing in light of the nonviolent Jesus?
Well, you know, to dehumanize another person is violent, whether you slap them in the face or talk ugly about them or take a gun and shoot them. It's all violence. All of those are various ways of being violent toward another person. And Jesus was never that. I mean, Jesus was always taking people as he met them and respecting them and listening to them and willing to go further than we are mostly ever willing to go. I don't think that most of the folks that sit in pews on Sunday have much of an idea who Jesus is. And that's part of the problem. I think that there's too much. We made up a Jesus to fit us, to fit our own narratives, to fit our way of being in the world, that Jesus isn't going to help us. We've really got to be, as Howard Thurman talks about, willing to follow the Jesus with his back against the wall.
Yes.
You know, the Jesus of the real Jesus Christ that was up against the Roman Empire and having to depend on God and bring a new way to be, a new way to see, and turning the world upside down. That's the nonviolent Jesus that we don't really want to have much to do with, because it's not the Jesus of the rich and the powerful and the warriors and the warmongers. That is not, there is no Jesus for them. You know, that means to try to, you know, I think it's so stupid to talk about holy wars and wars that are supposed to end all wars. Wars are not ever, one war is never going to end all wars, because you're always going to find something else to fight about if that's how you think you solve problems. So, you know, John, I'm so glad that you have this focus and that you stay on this focus, because I think in the religious world, we need to really reimagine what nonviolence really is about. Mm-hmm. Because our churches and religious institutions are pretty violent,
mm-hmm.
actually, when you get right down to the ways in which we behave and think and talk about each other, and that we can do something about that. We have to be willing to first name it and own it, and then say that's not the kind of humans we want to be.
Mm. Well, you just celebrated your 80th birthday. Congratulations. What sustains you on this journey, this lifetime work of yours?
Well, it's grace. It's more grace than anything, but it's, you know, this is what makes my heart sing. You know, Howard Thurman talks about find out what makes you come alive and
mm-hmm.
go do that.
Yeah.
That's it. This is it. I mean, this and playing with my essential oils and making greeting cards and trying to be kind to people. That's what makes my heart sing. And I love it. And I just keep on being given the energy to go do it. And I'm going to do it as long as I can. And so far, you know, it appears that I don't have any reason to stop. I feel good, and I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I just, like everybody else, it's an inconvenience. But people have all kinds of things that are inconveniences, and that's not a reason not to be faithful.
I encourage all our listeners to get Catherine's new book, Bridging the Rivers of Difference, A Proclamation of Unity and Resistance. If people wanted to be in touch with you or invite you for a workshop, how could they reach you?
So my website is just, my email is just cmeeks@turquoiseandlavender. And my website is just Turquoise and Lavender. If they just type, if they can't remember anything but Turquoise and Lavender and type that into the browser, the website will come up and my email is there.
Is there anything else before we close that you'd like to tell our listeners? Any last word of encouragement in these times to keep going forward and pursuing unity and resistance?
I think the most important thing is to work on trying to be at peace with yourself every day. And that one of the ways to do that is stay connected to beauty, stay connected to mystery, and just trust that yesterday was pretty good or not good, but that the same God that was there sustaining you yesterday will be here today and tomorrow.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Catherine Meeks, for speaking with me today. And thank you, friends, for listening to this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. You can hear many more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at www.beatitudescenter.org. And there you can sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about upcoming podcasts and Zooms. Please tell all your friends and church friends about the podcast to help to promote it. And I hope you also get my new book, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. If you're on Substack, look me up at Father John Deere. May the God of Peace bless you all. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus, resisting war, fascism, racism, injustice, and working for a more just, more nonviolent, more reconciled country and world. See you next time.